I'm Brett Hayworth, and welcome to What's the Frequency, our weekly show on Siouxland Public Media. 1 year ago, Republican President Donald Trump surged to a second term by winning the states of South Dakota, Iowa, and Nebraska, and of course, many states across the nation to win the Electoral College. At the time, Trump pledged to have a big impact on government, business, and the lives of people by cutting taxes, strongly enforcing immigration laws, and pushing back against liberal-minded social issues. And of course, his almost year as president has been a bevy of such steps, resulting in news cycle after news cycle, plus the backdrop of many of his actions drawing criticism. Last week, some high-profile elections nationally in such states as Virginia and New Jersey gave some data points for how Americans are feeling about the direction of the country. So this show is pointing ahead to 1 year from now for the November 2026 midterm elections, when control of the U.S. House and Senate chambers can be determined. To do that, I have a group of three Siouxland political science professors who have joined us now for four times in just a little over a year. The first was for the final months of the 2024 election cycle. Then about a year ago, we had the 2024 election dissection. And then we also took a look at the first 100 days of the Trump second term back in May. So, and now we're back to talk about the midterm. So, and those professors are Julia Helwig of the University of South Dakota, Patrick McKinley of Morningside University, and Bradley Best from Buena Vista University. Thank you guys all for coming back today.
Thanks for having us, Brett.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
To get started, I know a lot of this will be about the midterms and how the elections might look a year from now, but we have some, not necessarily breaking news, but there has been some change a little bit in the potential government shutdown. We're recording this early in the week. What the situation is when this airs on Friday, we don't know exactly, but what's the latest and what may have happened at the U.S. Senate?
Well, the big news right now is that on Sunday night, that eight Democratic senators agreed into conversations to make a compromise with the Senate Republicans to essentially offer a promise of a vote as opposed to holding an actual vote regarding the health care subsidies that are the major sticking point for this shutdown. So that's the big picture of what's happening. That's going to cause some rifts inside the Democratic Party. There are a lot of Democrats frustrated with these eight, feeling like maybe betrayal or sellout or compromise, those kinds of things. But the reality is that these were the moderates who, were the ones that were winnable votes for the Republican Party to be able to make some compromise. And so regardless of where you stand on the issue, this is what's happening, is that there are eight folks who have sort of agreed to a compromise for at least a promise of a vote. Now, of course, the big question is where the House, who had already voted, want to come back on this deal that the Senate decided to make. And that's the next step that we might not know right now, but that's in the coming days and maybe will be happening before Friday when this airs.
Yeah. Thank you, Professor Helwig. And then go ahead, Patrick McKinley.
Well, I was just going to suggest that we step back for a minute and see where we are. I think we're in day 41 of the longest shutdown in American history. It's had a lot of consequences. We're talking about what's happening with air traffic controllers and how many of them are catching certain forms of illness and not coming into work. And of course, they're frustrated because I think tomorrow will be their second or third paycheck that will not have arrived. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things going on with SNAP benefits or the lack thereof because of the shutdown, but also how both the administration and state governments are perceiving their access to emergency funds. There's a whole slew of things that have been ongoing. I'll throw this out for us to be thinking about later in the conversation, but we also haven't been getting a lot of economic data because a lot of our government agencies that collect and share this data, we don't know where we are on a lot of things. And so that's going to be something that, if this gets worked out, maybe we'll slowly get access to that. But we're, the Federal Reserve and Wall Street are kind of operating in the dark a bit on this. So just reminding ourselves that it's 41 days and counting.
Mm-hmm. And just because we have two male voices on the show, so that was Patrick McKinley. As we get going into the show, you'll be able to differentiate the voices a little bit better. But that was Patrick McKinley from Morningside University, and now Bradley Best from Buena Vista.
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is that one of the things that's in the backstory of this is that there's this kind of oft-quoted remark about the Senate, and it is that it takes 60 votes to do business in the United States Senate. And so the subject of the eight of the 8 Democrats who defected or who decided very late in the day yesterday to join Republicans in clearing a path for a floor vote on the spending packages that that have been so much in controversy is rooted in a couple of internal procedural considerations that are generally talked about in, you know, high school civics courses and political science courses and things like that. But it takes 60 votes to invoke the cloture rule to bring a filibuster to an end in the United States Senate. And so heading into this debate and until the eight departed their camp, the GOP seat advantage, which was 53-47, was simply not enough to move a bill forward in which there was a fair degree of consensus among Republicans. So what's interesting to me about that as a political scientist is that an internal procedural matter in that chamber has really profound effects and accounts for in part where we have been now for going on 41 days. Hence the call or demand from the president to waive the possibility of filibuster and therefore to render kind of void the idea of cloture in the Senate. So that's going to be something that's going to be talked about a bit moving forward. I would just add that the 8 folks that Julie refers to are all either electorally safe for one reason or another, either because they're retiring or they're simply not up for election in 2026. So we're not talking about 8 folks who, in terms of their own relationship with their own constituents, were in a particular position of vulnerability. That changes the story just a little bit and helps us to understand, I think, what might have happened there. But my colleagues are exactly right. There are fractures opening up today and overnight, and this is going to continue within the Democratic Party.
I might also note that 4 of them are former governors, which I think is an important part.
No, that was exactly one of the things I was thinking about, is that some of these are former governors who know how to make executive decisions, make those difficult sometimes decisions. That is very different from being a member of Congress. I also think that it's important to think about all of these things sort of together, right? Like, we have the rules of how the Senate and the House work, and we have the electoral vulnerability questions, these executive functioning kind of questions. But also, when we think about like what's actually going on with the shutdown, on one hand, it's been 41 days. On the other hand, it's also been a month shift. That makes a huge difference because we have these SNAP benefits that are not being paid out. And the other thing is that, of course, the subsidies question has already come into sort of practical effect, is that now we're in this point where folks are making decisions about which healthcare plans they want to choose. And they're seeing what the actual prices are now without those subsidies. And that makes a big practical difference. People are actually able to see what the costs are and what the needs are, right? And so if they don't have the government open and if we don't have the budget spending for these things, these are the consequences of that. And I think that makes it very much more real to individuals and to voters in that way.
And I guess one more on the shutdown before we move to other things. And again, for any of the 3 of your professors here for this What's a Frequency show, anecdotes that maybe you've seen in your personal life or with friends or that you've heard discussed with relatives or whatever, what is the impact on real people that maybe you, with people that you've talked with or encountered or, you know, your friend circle, whatever?
Well, my mom is a disabled person. She's a working disabled person. She goes to a doctor's office at least once, maybe 2 or 3 times a week. And she is on the marketplace shopping for her healthcare plan right now. And she makes about $14 an hour, and her plan went from $50 a month to $350 a month. Mm-hmm. That's the effect. And that's just one example. We've heard of many others out there that are, you know, astronomical when it comes to families or people in large areas. This is rural South Dakota.
I know of someone who is a single mom and is trying to hold down, I think, 3 or 4 jobs. But one of them is with a facility here that provides really important services for youth that are very underserved. And their federal funding has been cut, and so her hours got cut. So that, you know, it's, we don't always think about how this reverberates into other parts of the economy and into various organizations. It's not just that, you know, the Smithsonian's shut down. There's these direct impacts.
I don't know that I can add a whole lot to that other than to say that as a professor at Buena Vista University, I live in a community that is smaller than Sioux City, but not unlike Sioux City in the sense that there's a rather large number of food insecure families, food insecure households. And my colleagues who work in the field of social work as faculty as well as practitioners report just a tremendous amount of anxiety and distress that, that comes about in moments like this. And so it's the effect on the lives of Iowans, the effect on the lives of Americans, of circumstances like the shutdown and the effects of benefit streams and so on being interrupted, or even the threat of them being interrupted, is distressing and is something that people experience in real ways on the ground.
Sure, thank you. And again, that voice you just heard there was Professor Bradley Best. On What's a Frequency? We're trying to, I guess, maybe have some predictive powers a year from now for the 2026 midterm elections. I don't know. We'll hash it out. We'll see. I don't know. Predictive is maybe a little bit too strong a word. My professors, we have political science professors. We have Julia Helwig from the University of South Dakota, Bradley Best from Buena Vista University, and then Patrick McKinley from Morningside University. And I want to go back a little bit to the last time we gathered in May, which was on the 100 days of the Trump administration and how things stood at that point. And I guess maybe one takeaway from each of you, since I want to get into, first of all, who can best cite his Trump's favorable rating as we sit here in early November?
Is I can it get you very, 38, very close 37? To that number. He's at about 40%. That number oscillates back and forth a little bit depending on the polling agency, and there's more and more of those out there all the time. I do know that there's some, I think, credible, if not corroborated, evidence that he's losing ground or has lost ground in recent weeks with independents.
Okay. Julia?
Yeah, so the South Dakota News Watch and Cheeseman Center for Democracy, where I'm the director, we just released our October poll that we just did. And so while we don't have results on Trump necessarily this time, one of the main findings that we had is that unlike our April and last year's October poll, the independents are once again acting as moderates. And so we were for a while there seeing a lot of these independents really acting like Republicans, moderate Republicans. They were not distinguishable from one another when we actually did significance testing. But now on most of the things that we have looked at, and these are approval ratings, we have attitude questions, we have questions about democracy. So sort of across the board in a lot of these things, the independents are once again acting as moderates and really distinguishable between both the Democrats and the Republicans.
Okay, thank you. Patrick?
And if I can bring in another data point, because we've been, there's been a paucity, a lack of data, but one that I think also resonates well with both of your snapshots there is the Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index is nearing a record low. And so that says that the consumer is feeling a lot of stress. So it's folks who are food insecure, but it's a lot of economic insecurity seems to be reflected in that index.
Okay. What I was going to add, let me just ask this, and then we'll get into, I guess, more segmented questions, I guess, on the economy and the Supreme Court and such. But what would you say would be, for each of the three of you professors, Trump's most comprehensive, or no, not comprehensive, most consequential thing that he's done, just let's say since summer months and into the fall. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that he's done, but is there one that has really grabbed your attention that you think is top of mind, for, if not for you, for a lot of people?
This is not going to be a one that necessarily is headline grabbing for maybe your listeners here, but it's one that's been making me scratch my head, is these attacks on alleged narco trafficking vessels in both the Caribbean and in the Pacific close to Colombia, but a lot of apparent pressure on Venezuela. I know that this is not where most Siouxland listeners are focused, but that's one that is a very significant escalation that isn't completely clear from previous policy statements and so forth. So that's one that I think people need to keep an eye on. What is the end game there?
And just to give a point of that, that would be these strikes by the U.S. military in
not the Coast Guard, yeah. not drug enforcement, but
right.
It's the military
out in waters that are approaching the United States. These are supposed drug traffickers, but some people are calling it basically summary executions. There's no
and they're not really very close to U.S. waters. Yeah. Frankly, yeah. Those boats couldn't reach the U.S. So I mean, again, I don't know who those folks are and so forth, but it's in terms of international law, this is controversial.
I think what's, just to pick up on Patrick's point there, I think that what is interesting to me about what President Trump has been doing and what he often promises to do in the way that he speaks about so many issues, and this is a good example of this, and that is he frames his approach to a rather wide range of policy problems in the language or in the vernacular of emergencies, in the language of war, in the language of presidential war powers, and then acts on those policy concerns with uses of authority, with uses of the power and the influence of the United States government. We see him do this as well where tariffs are concerned, right? He invokes international economic emergencies as a concept and deploys what he perceives to be his authorities under federal statutes associated with that kind of thing. And as a result, it pushes our discussions, it pushes the national discussion about these sort of things into spaces of some ambiguity, right, about the exact scope of, or the allowable scope of executive power of either under Article 2 of the Constitution or under federal statutes, many of which have dates on them that begin with the 1700s, the 1800s, or maybe are 30, 40 years old. So a lot of what we see happening causes constitutional scholars, presidential scholars, and so on, and journalists as well, to try to ascertain the legality or the constitutionality of what is going on here, in part because what he is doing, and this is, I think, a key part of what Patrick just said, because of what he is doing is so extraordinary and is so outside the norm for us in so many ways, and is at the same time part of a larger program of moving an issue such as immigration, for example, out of the space of, say, of legislative politics, out of the space of domestic policy debate about how to address competing concerns, and into the domain of executive power and unitary action on the part of the president that is, again, on somewhat uncertain statutory and constitutional grounds.
Right. This wasn't like the U.S., the House, the Congress, the House or Senate saying, okay, we want to get tougher. We're gonna get rid of the 1790 whatever version, you know, of international waters, and we're going to, you know, any boat that comes within, you know, United States, suspected terrorist, suspected drug dealer, boom, you can shoot them. There's nothing like that at all. It's just executive correct? Right, as you're saying, Professor Best, yeah?
Correct.
No, I think this is very much tying into what I was thinking. You know, I think big picture, it's the anxiety and the fear that the general public and I think some decision makers feel as well, sort of not sure of what's the rules of the games anymore. Like the scope has just broadened to a point where we don't really know even what the rules could be, right? And so I think that fear and anxiety is a large part of the tactic. And so some of the issues that I was thinking of that have been sort of, I don't want to say highlights because that makes it seem like a sort of positive spin, but some of the major points over the last few months have been the anxiety and the fear that's been felt, especially among immigrant communities, but also in urban areas. And not only the sort of anxiety-driven approach to painting up the problem, but the over-militarization and policing to respond to the problem. And so you're playing up a problem that probably exists, but maybe not to that same extent, and then responding to a problem in a very large, grandiose kind of way. With, you know, we've seen these kind of occupation tactics of our major cities. And so those are, I think, very, very different from what we've seen before. Those are certainly ways to make people scared and make people think like, oh, well, maybe we should be doing something. And just the sort of lack of certainty of where do we go from here. And that also means that decision makers have a very hard time figuring out like how to respond to policies because they wouldn't even have considered some of those options, right? It's like beyond the negotiation. I think that also ties in with what's going on with the shutdown as well. The sort of how do you negotiate with terrorists kind of thing, right? Well, we shouldn't. Well, but if we don't, then. And so I think that's a lot of what both Democrats and establishment Republicans are feeling right now is that like the conversation has shifted so much that we can't even tie it back into what are the major talking points. And if we lose ground, well, that might happen, but we have to be able to at least keep in the, you know, some semblance of making decent policy. Because like if we talk about these SNAP benefits, for example, the healthcare marketplace, right? The very people who Democrats are attempting to support through these programs are the ones who are losing right now. So if Democrats don't negotiate, well, then the very people who they're trying to support are losing out even more, right? And that's the tactic that the Republican Party is using right now. And that makes it very challenging. And I think that's emblematic of a lot of these issues that we've seen throughout the summer with the occupation of cities, the over-policing, or the immigration concerns, or now the shutdown.
Okay, and I want to get one more thing, I guess, court-wise, U.S. Supreme Court-wise, from some of the things that all three of the professors just said. There are so many, again, so many actions by President Trump, a lot of them in executive order type fashion. And I'm curious, what are the key things that the Supreme Court is caught up on, so to speak, on existing cases concerning like immigration, and other topics, the tariffs? Where do some of those stand? Has the U.S. Supreme Court heard them? Are they about to hear of them? And I know that's a pretty broad topic there, and there's a lot to be covered there, but go ahead, Patrick.
I'm going to defer to you guys on some of the different topics, but I want to pay attention to the tariff discussion first and foremost. The court has heard, this comes back to what you were saying earlier, Brad, about this kind of expansion, you know, this expression of unitary power of the executive, of kind of pretty significant claims about the scope of executive power and using emergency justifications for invoking certain legislation to enact these tariffs. And some folks have been surprised at the specific statutes that the administration has cited to justify some of their tariffs, because frankly, they may have had a little bit more legislative ground to stand on if they'd followed certain statutes rather than the ones that they did in a lot of these cases. And so special courts have heard these tariff cases and have ruled against the administration, basically saying that a lot of, not all, but some of these tariffs have been inconsistent with the law. And so now it's before the Supreme Court. And for a court that has a lot of members who are, whether you call them originalists or some other variation of judicial philosophy, the power to tax typically belongs to the legislative branch, and tariffs are very much considered. And if you hear the arguments that were given last week, that was what you heard from many members of the court saying, this is a way of raising revenue. This is a form of taxation. So it's going to be interesting to see how the court wrestles with this, the tariff discussion. A lot of folks can have different opinions about the pros and cons of tariffs, but the way in which the administration has pursued it is unique.
Right.
And the court is considering it. It's already heard the case. So,
you know, to expand a little bit on something that Patrick just said, I would kind of refer everyone back to a 1952 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, a case called Youngstown Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer. And of the many things that came out of that decision, and I cite that because among the things that the Supreme Court indicated and that the majority indicated in the opinion for the court in response to a course of action taken by President Truman at the time is that the legislative function, the lawmaking function, belongs to the Congress, and that when presidents do things that take on a legislative character, they are at, and this is paraphrased language from the opinion, the president is at a high point in the president's powers to do so when the president is acting in a way that is consistent with an express preference or wish of the Congress. And the president is at the lowest point that he or she could possibly be at in the exercise of executive power when they're acting contrary to legislative authority. What we're seeing here is I would sort of characterize this as a course of presidential action that is, again, in that circumstance of ambiguity. And what Patrick is referring to is some early signs that the judiciary is becoming a bit more skeptical about specific uses of presidential authority, particularly in the area of tariffs. What I would say just generally about the president's encounters with the judiciary, if there is a pattern, it seems to be more or less this. And that is the president in this administration doesn't fare especially well in the lower federal courts. They are much more apt to grant injunctive relief or to issue a stay in the use of a presidential authority. But as those disputes work their way through the federal judiciary in the direction of the Supreme Court, there's been an overall, accommodationist kind of vibe, if you will, among the members of the Supreme Court where these uses of executive power are concerned. But we may be seeing some early signs of that the courts are ready to dig their heels in at the highest levels.
Okay, thank you. That's Professor Bradley Best, and now to you, Julia Helwig.
I do think that it's very well known that, you know, the court right now is primarily made up of originalist judges, but I do think that over the last few months we've seen some sort of maybe surprises or inconsistencies from sort of breaking with the expectations but the expectations of what a true originalist court would do, and they have been a little bit more moderate, I suppose, than the expectations. And so the big decision from this week, of course, is that the Supreme Court has decided not to revisit the Obergefell versus Hodges gay marriage decision. And so it's kind of a weird case where we're looking at, like, not what decision is the Supreme Court going to make, but a lot of the decisions that Supreme Court makes is actually happening way before it comes out to the Supreme Court decision. It happens at the stage where they decide whether to hear a case or not.
Right.
And so when we teach constitutional law, one of the main things that we talk about is the process by which something gets up to the Supreme Court. And very few cases make it up there. And then that final stage is sort of figuring out, well, are they even going to hear it? And that is an important decision in and of itself. And so it's already sort of been decided that, nope, that's done. We're not touching it. That's settled decision.
Thank you, Professor Julia Helwig. We're back for more for this edition of What's the Frequency. We're looking at the midterm elections about 1 year from now. We're just getting through the, well, here in Iowa, we had our municipal, our school board elections, but then there are also a bunch of elections throughout the United States that we're going to talk about here in a second. But my guests this week are Professors Julia Helweg of the University of South Dakota, Patrick McKinley of Morningside University, and Bradley Best from Buena Vista University. And I do want to get back to what I referenced at the beginning. So last week in the national election, so there's been a lot of data points, a lot of elections, a lot of special elections, not just last week with those governorships of New Jersey and Virginia, but there's also been some other special elections in the state legislatures that have happened over in recent weeks. Is it accurate that for the most part those have been good from what Democrats want to see happening in electing candidates? Those have typically trended toward Democrats. Is that correct?
Yeah, it seems the pendulum is swinging in the favor of Democrats this season. I think one addition that I would make is Ketanji Halva, who was elected in a special election for the House, and who Mike Johnson just announced would be included in that vote related to the shutdown. And so that's a switch from what he had originally stated, but I think one that has been put pressure on that Halva was elected and has not been able to be sworn in and sort of waiting on the shutdown. But now Mike Johnson switched on that. And so, yes, I do think it seems that, overall nationwide, that the swing is coming back in the opposite direction from last year.
Do you think it's thermostatic? You know, is it that or is it other dynamics? And I'm not sure I'm the one to describe the thermostatic theory of electoral politics, but it's like a temperature gauge. It's sometimes too hot, it's sometimes too cold, and then it moves back and forth with the election cycle. So and typically, and this is anticipating where we'll end up, I'm sure, the party in power that has the presidency tends to have a rougher time in the following midterm elections. There's only been two exceptions where they've actually won seats.
I was going to ask if one of the three of you knew that. So yeah. Twice in history, it hasn't gone.
Yeah, in the post-war era.
Modern, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Well, and the real question is that does the party in power, does the president's party in particular tend to lose seats as a result of, again, these thermostatic effects that we're talking about? And that is the electorate, does the electorate step in to in some way moderate or attempt to moderate what might be a bit of overreach or overstretch on the part of a majority that was swept into office under conditions of a lot of enthusiasm, you know, a year or two prior? And then the midterm election, we've just come out of what we would call an off-year election, just earlier in November, but the midterm time, is that some sort of correction? Is that a corrective to again, the tendency on the part of a majority, particularly under conditions of unified government, to go a bit too far? And that thesis is out there. The other possibility is that the midterm seat losses of the president's party are in part an artifact of the institutional arrangements under which we elect members of Congress and the House in particular. And that is, whatever the mobilizing effects were that were in place leading up to November 2024 that account for that huge, I mean, literally almost jurisdiction by jurisdiction shift in support in the direction of President Trump, a lot of those voters won't show up in November of 2026, and that has the effect of putting at further risk any Republicans who were elected by narrow majorities in their district, in their House district. And if you combine that with what seems to be at least a little bit of an indication here, I don't want to go quite as far as I'm reading some people in the way that some people are depicting this as, you know, a blue surge or something like that that happened on November 4th. I don't know that that is there, but there is definitely something moving in the waters. If it's not a surge, it's something short of that. political scientists, journalists are paying a lot of attention these days to Loudoun County, Virginia, right? A jurisdiction with that an area of the country that Harris won by, I think, 15 or 16 points, but the governor of Virginia, the new governor of Virginia, governor-elect now of Virginia, won by nearly 30 points. And that's taken as a bellwether. We also saw what happened in New Jersey as well. And there's reason to wonder if the affect overall collectively of the electorate is shifting, or at the very least, if Democrats are awakening again, and we'll see if that has staying power moving into November of 2026.
Thank you, Professor Bass. And just to put a little finer point on it, Virginia is considered a slightly red state or a purple state, or how would we describe Virginia? Has it been swinging a little bit?
I think purple at least, but I wouldn't call it red. It did elect a Republican governor 4 years ago, and again, that's kind of the thermostatic model after President Biden's win in 2020. Then it was one of the first states that started to show that kind of concern about Democratic unified control. So it was kind of that. It's the opposite of what just happened this past Tuesday.
And I'm not sure if you said this, Professor Best, but if you didn't, the governor who won, the Democratic governor, was the first female governor in Virginia history, correct?
Yeah, Governor elect Abigail Spanberger.
There you go, yeah. I'm sorry.
She's one who, I don't know if folks remember, but she's the one who was sort of famous with a picture of her daughter between her legs as she won her congressional seat. But I do think it's a good question of, like, sort of how are the electorate responding? Is it that it's this sort of thermostatic anti-incumbent, if you will, kind of response, the backlash effect? You know, we're just not happy with what's going on in government, and Congress generally has a very low approval rating. If you can, it's more of a how big is their disapproval level, right? And, you know, I think that's often part of the story. The other part is, well, are they actually sophisticated policy responders? Are the policies working? Are they actually feeling like they are getting the promise, you know, that Trump and the Republican Party gave them? And so that's a slightly different kind of response, right? Yes, it could have the same effect, but, you know, maybe they're sophisticated in terms of responding to policy. But then I do think that there's a big part of this that's about turnout. And turnout often is about the motivation, but it also is this institutional factor. We know that people just don't go and vote unless the president is at the top of that ticket, right? And so that matters for off-term elections, it matters for midterm elections, and it definitely matters for primary elections. And that's, of course, you know, South Dakota, for us, that's the big question now, is with a governor's race next year and it being a primarily Republican state with close Republican primaries, the people who go and vote in off elections tend to be more partisan. The people who vote in primary elections tend to be even more partisan. And so these kinds of questions will have an effect on the upcoming elections in the next year or so. And that's one of the things that we saw in New York City, of course, was that they had record turnout. And that happens when you have a backlash effect, and you need to have very charismatic and sort of top-of-ticket, exciting elections. They want to see competition. The electorate doesn't want to come out and turn out if they don't think that they have any efficacy, that they don't matter for the election.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Professor Helwig. And now we're back for one more segment here on What's the Frequency? We're looking ahead to the 2026 midterm elections that are 1 year from now. We have Professor Julia Helwig from South Dakota. We have Bradley Best from Buena University and Patrick McKinley of Morningside University. They're all political science professors, and they've been very helpful over four times in like 15 months coming in and hashing through various topics. And I really appreciate having you guys back again today. Just before the last break, Julia got into right where I was going to go next, which was to explain what will be on the actual ballot next year. So certainly President Trump is, you know, there's no presidential election, but in Iowa, South Dakota, Nebraska, there'll be congressional races. There'll be all the legislative races for 2 and 4 year positions. and there's governor races in Iowa and South Dakota as well. So I kind of wanted to get to dig into all three of those. All three governors in the tri-state area are all Republicans. So we have Jim Pillen in Nebraska. We have Kim Reynolds, who is vacating her seat, so that will be an open seat in Iowa.
Larry Roden
in South Dakota. That's
yeah,
okay.
It's an interesting case, right? Because it could have been an open one, but ended up not being. So it's an incumbent, but he hasn't been elected before.
Right. So that was in January when Kristi Noem became the Department of Homeland Security. That was then turned over to him. And so now, if we could just talk kind of generally, Julia, for the governor's race. It seems like the Republicans running are very conservative and maybe trying to out-conservative each other,
That's a good question. I do think that we're seeing two main camps of sort of the more establishment, bit more moderate Republican camp in Dusty Johnson, who's also been a member of Congress now for some time, and Larry Roden, who, yes, is much more conservative, but still not as conservative as the two other folks running, John Hansen and Toby Doden. And so, yes, maybe out-conservating themselves, but I do think also that the race is being pulled to the right by these statewide holding officials. So John Hansen is majority leader, and Toby Doden is sort of the outside, I've called him sort of a disruptive candidate, right? Mm-hmm. He's trying to focus on what are the conservative values and certainly bringing the race to the right. But I do think that Dusty Johnson still holds the more sort of moderate establishment wing. He certainly pulled a bit further to the right in being, sort of a good party foot soldier with the Republican Party while in Congress. But he's certainly different from the other three in the race.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Professor Helwig. And then I want to ask about so Dusty Johnson is giving up the congressional seat. So do you think it is likely that it's been a Republican seat for so long is that the likely outcome, the expectation?
The expectation is certainly that there'll be a Republican winning, that the race is primarily at the primaries for a lot of these races. And so to that end, the Cheeseman Center and the South Dakota News Watch, we did our poll for GOP only to ask about name recognition and favorability. And so Marty Jackley is running for that seat and, had 47% overall among GOP voters favorability rating, and 13% who did not recognize his name, compared to and the other folks are running, Bailota and Crabtree, who had very high levels of not recognizing the names. And so we know that in South Dakota, 51% of registered voters are Republican, with about 25% independents and 22% Democrats. And so it really is primarily a primary kind of race. And that said, part of that is precisely because the independents are not able to vote in that Republican primary.
And that's a recent change in South Dakota, correct? No?
No, there was an open primary initiative a couple years ago that did not pass.
Okay.
And so we still have a closed primary on the Republican side, but the Democrats do offer an open primary, so independents are able to vote in that primary. Of course, anyone is able to change their registration in advance of the election.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for getting me straight on that, Professor Helwig. And thank you for the giving the lay of the land in South Dakota. So now I want to turn to Iowa. And I realized I was remiss when I described Kim Reynolds not running again. We also have another longtime female office holder, Senator Joni Ernst, who is not running for the U.S. Senate. So there's two very notable bowing outs, I guess, by the Governor Kim Reynolds and also Joni Ernst. So either Bradley Best or Patrick McKinley, do you any thoughts on whether those are attainable by Democrats for the Democrat to get the governor or the U.S. Senate race?
I think I'm going to step back a little broader to talk about these Iowa races and Iowa in general. I mean, we've had a period of Iowa kind of becoming more red over the last number of cycles. And it appears, you know, we up until about 6 weeks ago, we had a supermajority in the Senate. And so that was having for the Republicans. And so that looked like it was solidly a one direction for the state. That was broken recently with the special election of Caitlin Dray. But we're also seeing that, I think, if I can take us back to the broader issues, and, you know, I'm the one brought up the thermostatic theory of elections. But one of the things that President Trump had talked about, and a lot of folks think was part of his winning strategy in 24, was dealing with the cost of living and inflation and matters like that. Well, lo and behold, here we are in 25, and whether we're talking about healthcare premiums or we're talking about the price of coffee or the price of whatever, affordability is on everyone's lips these days. Mm-hmm. But if we dig down, and this is where we're going to need to know more about what's happening in each state. Iowa has been having a rough time economically as a state. We're not growing as fast. In fact, there have been some analysts that say that Iowa may be in a recession right now. You know, whereas the rest of the nation looks like it's, you know, growing somewhat, but Iowa has been having some challenges, and going back to the tariffs and some of China's retaliation that's impacted our farm markets and so forth like that. I think that from a broader level, when you think about some of these big issues reverberating across the Iowa electorate, one cannot predict that what happened 2 years ago is going to happen next year. I'm not predicting anything in terms of how this party or another party, but I think it's a little bit more open than people may have originally thought.
Okay, thank you, Patrick McKinley. And then go ahead, Professor Best.
I think the question on my mind is I would like to know kind of empirically how much buyer's remorse is out there among Republicans and folks that in 2024 were independents, but persuadable independents, in which we know that the majority of independent identifiers are independent leaners. And where I'm going with this is that I would be interested to know how many folks who cast that straight ticket Republican ballot in Iowa in pursuit of a tough and aggressive approach to immigration and to, quite frankly, pursue what was offered up to them and so many of those folks very eagerly consumed, which was an anti-woke agenda. They got both in grand style. We know that public institutions, public organizations, public universities, lots of private organizations who depend on federal funding as well, who have divested themselves significantly of a lot of what are portrayed as left-leaning social engineering kind of policy approaches. But the cost of that has been some very significant threats to the health of the farm economy. Iowa is a world leader in the production of soybeans, and we know that a very high percentage of Iowa's soybeans production was shipped immediately to China. Now, a trade deal in recent days has brought about a situation where the Trump administration has reversed course on that subject, as well as, you know, backing off of tariffs and some promises on the part of the Chinese to resume purchasing Iowa soybeans. To tie this into the subject of the midterm elections, we tend to ask as political scientists, I think everyone asks us, is what is the national mood going to be in a year, and to what extent will Iowans hold the incumbents and folks who are running for open seats in Iowa accountable for the course of action pursued by their president? And that is yet to be known. But we're gonna know in a year. And I'm with Patrick. I think that there is daylight in there in the uh, uh, in for Democrats in Iowa. I don't know how much. I would tend to say, if I had to handicap it, that there's an uphill road, an uphill battle to be fought by Democratic candidates in Iowa, Rob Sand included. So.
Mm-hmm. I do think those two final points are very important. One of those, right, is we're a year out, and we know that voters' memory is very short, right? We want to see what's in our pocketbook right now and what do the policies look like right now. And so whatever may have happened a year earlier, or a year and a half earlier, or even 3 months earlier, are often a distant, distant memory when it comes to the actual ballot. The other thing is whether there will be some consistency between the presidential vote in the previous year and then governors and Congress, right? Those are different offices. Certainly same parties are the players, but it's not always certain how voters will reconcile somebody running for governor a year later, 2 years later, right? As opposed to the president. And so different times, different offices. That said, I do think that some of this backlash, thermostatic voting, anti-incumbent sentiments, you know, those are common and probably something that we'd expect to see as a big picture pattern. But I'm with these two. I'm not going to make any predictions at this time.
Thank you. And some of the things that all three of you have said here in the last few seconds make me realize we're basically winding down for our discussion here. But I appreciate a lot of overview, a lot of overarching type look that we were able to do. And I appreciate you being willing to come in. And I know to get you to pontificate it, like, you know, this is how the election is going to go. That's not necessarily we want to at least air some issues of how next year could look. So, but I really appreciate you guys coming in. Before I let you go, all three of you, Patrick McKinley, Bradley Best, and Julie Helwig, is there anything about the midterm elections and us being a year out, before I let you go, that we haven't talked about that you want to make one last point before we wrap here?
Worthwhile point to make is what occurred recently in California, Proposition 50, and the effect of a change constitutionally in the state of California, in terms of how legislative districts are drawn. It will now be a legislatively driven plan, and that appears in all likelihood to be favoring the prospects for Democratic candidates in California. Now, I know that takes us out of the context of the races here in Iowa, but it probably affects half a dozen or so races for the U.S. House in California. And that certainly breaks into that, certainly cleaves off some of the built-in electoral advantage as a result of a lengthy program of gerrymandering in states like Texas that have worked to the detriment of Democrats. So again, it's a little bit of a reversal of fortune, and We do often wonder about the effects of momentum as well. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder, will voters in Iowa, will Democrats in Iowa see momentum building in other parts of the country, whether that is the narrow confines of a place like Loudoun County, Virginia, or in the state of California, and be activated by that, be motivated by that. But again, as you said, we're a year out, and there's a lot of innings to play yet before we reach the ninth in this event.
And just to make sure if I'm saying this correctly, so when the current Congress, and I know there's been a few special elections sent, but basically when the 435 House members were elected a year ago, the districts, how the districts look at that point could look quite a bit different in quite a few states. So how the number of seats that favor one party or the other, that is potentially, or that will be changing by 11 and a half months from now.
It has moved a small but not insignificant number of states into a competitive status where they once were not, or at least where they were tending so likely in the direction of the Republican Party in 2024.
Did you have one final point, Julia?
Yeah, I think the big thing I would say is that I think a lot of folks are feeling a frustration with government right now, and that's creating a lack of motivation to want to engage. And I think that makes me really concerned. And I've written on this before about how, you know, sort of economic hard times can make people not want to engage. And there's a few select people who, like, you know, well, once the going gets tough, the tough get going, right? And I think that's what I'd like to encourage folks, is that if you are feeling frustrated and if you're feeling demotivated by government, that's precisely the time to start getting engaged as opposed to disconnecting. And I think related to that, as we're talking about the midterm elections and big national elections, and sort of talking about gubernatorial elections being the lower levels, I'd also like to remind folks that there's a bunch of local elections happening too, and not just state legislative elections, but also your school board elections and your local municipal elections. And those happen throughout the year in various places. And these are often the lowest turnout kind of elections, but these really matter to your community. I sit on our local city council and I'm up for election next year. And you know, if I could break 200 votes in my little ward, that would be fantastic. And so I think it's really important to remember that your local decisions are made by your community members and your neighbors, and go out there and get voting and get engaged. And, you know, if you're mad, then go and do something about it.
Okay, thank you. And that'll be a wrap for this edition of What's the Frequency? And thank you again to the group of our three political science professors that we've that have been nice enough to keep coming back and agree to come back and discuss more more various subjects over the last several months. Julia Helweg from the University of South Dakota, the last voice you heard there, Bradley Best of Buena Vista University, and then Patrick McKinley from Morningside University. Thanks to all of you guys.
Thank you.
And that'll be a wrap for this edition of What's a Frequency? As we move deeper into a second year for the show, thanks for being a part of our station as we work every day to tell the stories about Siouxland that inform, entertain, and expand the mind. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week. What's a Frequency airs on Fridays at 10 a.m. and again on Sundays at 2 p.m. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Brett Hayworth.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.